Hi, and welcome to Michael Cremer's podcast series. Today, it's my pleasure to have Irene Mosden in the studio. Welcome, Irene.
Hello, Michael. Hello, everyone.
Nice to have you. And Irene and I have known each other for a number of years. And as a result of that, I thought it'd be really interesting to spend quite a lot of today's podcast talking about leadership. And when we get to that part of it, you'll understand why, because Irene's got a pretty unique and interesting background. But Irene, before we get to kind of what you've been doing over the last few years and talking about leadership as from a CRE point of view, maybe you could just start and talk a little bit about school, university. Did you go? How did you get into the property game?
Right. Okay. Well, actually, I didn't go to university. I did go to college way back in the days when I was being educated. It was very much about the whole focus, especially being a woman, was that you went to college and you did a good sort of degree that helped you fulfill your job as a wife, more or less, you know, and a job was something extra to have. So I actually, in those days, wanted to go into HR. So that's where I sort of started as a PA in those days. You were next to God because you were the PA to the managing director or chairman. And then I got qualified in HR and I went into HR. Had great time doing that. I worked for some really interesting companies at some really interesting time. Saatchi & Saatchi being probably one of the biggest ones at the time when they were talking about the pregnant man and, you know, all those wonderful adverts. Very creative time, very fun time in my 20s. Mm. And then the company secretary said, actually, I'd like you to take a look at property, take a look at personnel, admin, property, all that sort of stuff. So I said, well, I'm not doing that unless you start training me on it. And that's really how I came into property.
And was that, you're obviously from Scotland, was that in Scotland or did you move to London or somewhere else at this point?
No, I'm a bit of a misnomer there because, yes, I've got Scottish parents or had Scottish parents, but actually I didn't live in Scotland until I went to college because my father was in the Air Force. So I was brought up around the world, so travel was sort of in my DNA, I suppose. So I came down to London. My parents were living in Hampshire at the time. The obvious place to work was London, and that's where I wanted to be. That's where it was all happening.
And so this training that you mentioned, can you just talk a little bit about that? Was that, you obviously made a sensible decision and told them that you needed to be trained in what you were going to do. Was that RACS training when you say that, or was it back to college? Or
it was a combination of doing college courses. It was a combination of going on specific courses to do with specific things. You know, if I wanted to acquire, if I wanted to understand leases and how you, the different terms of leases, and if you wanted to work in different geographies, how did you go about doing that? But one of the biggest things was, by then I was working in Computer Sciences Corporation, which was a big American company that was doing IT outsourcing, and they sent me over to the US to learn how to really do due diligence on mergers and acquisitions for property. Mm. And I probably found that I learned more in those 9 years of actually doing that type of work, which has held there. It's really been my foundation for everything that I've done since, because it was such a good grounding in understanding how people look at property when they're acquiring businesses, when they're divesting businesses, and also when they're looking at the impact of property to a business and to its balance sheet. So that really was my foundation, I think.
And was that, there's a couple of interesting things in there, but they were sending you back for a short period of time to train, or were you living in the US?
It was back and forward. I was literally doing transatlantic travel, and I was also learning on the job, because at that time, computer sciences was the main competitor to EDS. It was growing hugely in Europe, and they had asked me to take on all the property due diligence with these red teams that would fly over from the US looking at great big outsourcing, IT outsourcing contracts like British Aerospace and all the others.
Yeah, again, that sort of technology, the first go round of the big technology companies growing by M&A and all being American companies and coming to Europe and buying up everything that they could to expand.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big shift from the woman in HR to the woman in property, which you kind of went, well, I did a few courses and then, you know, I knew how to do it. But
no, I made many, many mistakes along the way. But the one thing that I learned very, very quickly was to surround yourself by the right people and really people that were deep-rooted experts in specific areas and build that team together. Because once you've got that team culture and that interdependency on each other, I knew what questions to ask, but I relied on them to really work through the deep-rooted technical problems, because I never envisaged I was going to become a deep-rooted property expert, because, you know, some see me as that today, strangely enough, but to my mind, I was always going to be somebody where I had enough knowledge that I knew what questions to ask, and then there were experts that I could rely on and partner with.
And do you think the HR background, let's call it, that you started in HR, as you said, and which is for many reasons fascinating, not least of which, because today all we do is talk about talent and the war for talent, and we don't talk about property in the same way at all. But is that grounding, if you like, in HR, did that help you in that, what you've just described, which to me is the sort of the beginning maybe of your leadership, meaning you surround yourself with experts, you get them to do the detailed subject matter expert stuff, and you're now running a team, maybe, as you said, with less deep-rooted knowledge than them, but with something else which is much arguably more valuable to your company, which is getting the right people to do the right job as a team.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because when I think about HR back in those days, it wasn't even called HR, it was called personnel.
Yeah.
And it was really focusing on the people.
Right.
And all the people-related issues and people-related problems. It wasn't so much about process. So if I think about it, yes, it was emerging as a people manager and a people person was far more important, I think, in knowing what to look for and how to get the best out of people, and letting people fail, actually. That's something I've learned through the years. You have to let people fail and support them when they have.
Support them when they have, and hopefully they don't make the same mistake again.
Absolutely.
I'm allowed to do that once, maybe twice, but certainly not three times.
Absolutely.
And so you're at Computer Science Corporation. You're running a team of real estate experts looking across Europe. Was that team all based in one place at that point, or was it?
No,
it was,
they were everywhere. They were all across Europe.
And in days before the technology we have now, so that just butt in and ask a question around that, because perhaps easier today to run remote teams because of technology. In the days that you were doing it, and I remember them well, it was much harder because you didn't have the same technology. So how did you go about running a team that was spread across geography?
Well, quite a lot of the team actually was external, and it was in the days before corporate solutions in the real estate companies.
Right.
But I found a really good guy in a company that I had been told to use by the US, who was based in Europe. And I said to him that I needed to have the right people to contact across the different geographies across Europe, because that was my remit at the time. And he sort of set that up for me. And we used to have weekly calls. It was much more about communication through speaking on the phone. And in some ways, you got to know people that much better before the days of email, because the communication on the written word took so much longer.
Right.
It was easier to pick up the phone and make things happen. I quite miss that sometimes, actually, the whole people bit.
I've talked quite a lot with people on these podcasts about that, the fact an email can be read in 10 different ways, a phone call much less so, and obviously meeting someone in person. Lesson we all grew up in, though, you went and saw someone. If you couldn't see them, you phoned them.
Yeah.
And we didn't have email, so you had to write them a letter, which took as long as it took to get there. So, you know, that was more the formal end of something when you were papering an agreement rather than the communication to get a deal done.
Yeah.
So it's a very different world now, which I think throws up a whole bunch of other interesting challenges.
And I think in the, especially, and I'm talking now in the 80s, 90s time, companies didn't worry about travel expenditure quite the way they do today. So you did find yourself traveling, or people traveling to you, and you met much more. So it was far more about getting people together and physical presence than it was relying on technology.
And so just maybe talk a little bit about you obviously then decided at some point to move from computer science, and I don't know if the next stop was Shell. or whether I'm fast-forwarding too much.
You're fast-forwarding a bit too much. I've got a long career, Michael. No, the next step was really I went for a year into, because I decided what I would call going on the dark side. I wanted to go onto the supplier side to see what it was like. And BT was outsourcing all of its property at the time and all of its FM. And I was asked to go in and head up the operations. And what had happened is three companies had come together and created a JV. They'd sold this amazing model to BT. And they said, it was called BT Jaguar at the time. I'm sure you'll remember it. And it was a very big contract at the time. And I went in as operations director. And then about 6 weeks later, they asked me to take on the total responsibility for delivering it. So I did that for a year, actually made that happen, where they outsourced just short of 9,000 properties across the UK. It was a great time to do it because I had to bring together a massive team to make it all happen. But then I was approached by Standard Chartered Bank to take on a global job, and that sounded far more interesting. So that's when I went off to start global travel.
So that's the point that you've done a lot of work in Europe, and the next part of your career growth, I guess, for you was the, okay, is there a global job out there that I can get to continue to learn? So clearly the idea of working in different cultures and cities and places is appealing.
Yes, absolutely.
And again, back to the sort of the question around leadership. So now you've got a global role, so you've got even more of a disparate team. And this is in the 90s?
That's in the 90s.
In the 90s.
So going into 2000s. Yeah.
Yeah. So you go to Standard Chartered, so European business, British-based bank, but you're doing a global job.
Yes.
And fundamentally different to working for a technology company from America or even BT, I should imagine.
Yeah.
So what were the things that you, again, are you still, you're obviously learning at this point, but you're past the point of going on courses that you were talking about earlier, or are you still learning that way, or is this now all on the job learning?
It's much more on the job learning, much more on the job learning. In fact, what happened at that point in time in my career is it turned the other way around and I ended up teaching because I joined Cornet Global. And because I was part of Standard Chartered Bank, I was in Standard Chartered for the UK for a year. And then they asked me to go out and be based in Asia. So that was great. I went off to Singapore and spent most of my time traveling Asia, but coming back to the UK quite often. And at the time in Asia, property again, and having property professionals out in Asia, by and large, they were expats. And there was a real desire in Cornet Global and in a lot of the universities across Asia to start building local talent. So I was involved in their master's corporate real estate program, where they were looking for people that had quite a number of years, and by then I had had quite a number of years experience in dealing with property, to help them create these training courses and train locals across Asia. So I found that really interesting. Enjoyed doing that.
Yeah, and we've obviously run across each other on the Cornet board, and I taught some of those courses. I'm sure not nearly as well as you did, but
I'm sure you did, Michael.
So now you're it's not poacher turned gamekeeper, but you're now teaching the courses. You're in this very significant global job. How did you approach leadership or running those teams? Because everyone knows there's a difference between managing teams and leading teams.
Yeah,
I think at the beginning you were talking more about getting teams together and surrounding yourself with experts, which is in a way managing them. How would you describe, is it just something you do and you kind of do it instinctively, or is there certain things that you need to be thinking about as you get into that global role, because there's a lot more going on?
Yeah, I do think you have to think much more carefully about how you put that team together and what it is that you're responsible for, and who are the right people to do it, and where's the talent, and where's the future talent. So you have to quite quickly recognize, and at that time in Standard Chartered, one of the reasons why they wanted me to go to Singapore and Asia was that we needed to create a fully fledged property function, because at that time it was just countries were doing their own thing, very much managing their own way and acquiring property in their own way and running branches in their own way. And there was this real push to globalize and to start really having common standards and practices and how you got best practice out to some of the countries where they perhaps hadn't looked at it like that, because it wasn't the cultural way of doing things. So it was really trying to work out, first of all, what was there, understand what talent was there or where there were gaps, and then identifying how you could plug those gaps. And sometimes it wasn't just plugging them with, you know, bringing in expats to do it, but actually constantly seeing what's available in the supply chain that you could bring in to work with you and supplement your teams, to support your teams. I think that's one of the biggest leadership challenges that you have, is really trying to get people to get out of this mindset of there's suppliers and there's clients.
Yeah.
It's how do you work together? Because whenever I talk about my team, it's my extended team, it's everybody that's involved in it, and I know that that sometimes gets people quite uncomfortable. I'm finding that particularly now that I'm in the public sector, because it's not a concept that is accepted readily. I've jumped forward now, but yeah, that but is the case.
But you're not going to get away with that so easily. We'll come on to that. Well, one of the other things, and in a way is a segue to that, so working for the bank, and we were talking about this off air, as it were, but the stakeholders and shareholders, and how do you manage up? Because typically the head of a global corporate real estate is reporting into the C-suite or close to it. So now you're dealing with people who aren't real estate people, who may not even understand real estate, but are smart business people, very smart around numbers. I mean, they obviously know what they're doing. They just don't see real estate either as necessarily as something that helps the business sell more, produce more, whatever it happens to be, but almost as a necessary evil.
Yeah.
So how do you figure out that stakeholder management?
Yeah, there's stakeholder management, but this whole question of the C-suite, and it was really, really the thing to talk about in the 90s and going into the 2000s, is, you know, how do you get presence in the C-suite? Actually, I've never had a problem getting presence in the C-suite. In fact, it's the reverse. I get too much attention from the C-suite. And the way that I look at it, and I've always said this with people, is that you need to be looking at the business first, and what is it the business really need? If you talk to them about, you know, an office needs to be 200 square feet or 15 square meters or whatever you want it to be, doesn't mean anything to a businessman. He just doesn't understand what that looks like. And that really came across to me when I went into one meeting in Standard Chartered. And it was a board meeting, and I was talking to the board, and I was explaining to them that, you know, our utilization rate was at X square feet per person, and we were doing sort of things, and our average office size was whatever it was. And they said, my CFO said to me, but what does that actually mean to me, Ari? I'm not sure I understand the question. He said, well, that bin over there, he said, tell me, what does that cost me a year to sit there? And it really came home to me that actually I was talking about the wrong things. Because to him, it didn't matter if that bin was however much space it was occupying. It's what was it costing him, and what was the effect on his profitability for having that there? And was there another way of doing it? So to my mind, and that's when we started turning everything around how we used data and how we used the management information. We started looking at what the effect of property is on the balance sheet. And as soon as we started, and on profitability, as soon as we started talking about that, I had no problem at all getting the attention of the CEO and the board. None whatsoever.
And that's really a financially driven way of looking at property. And by financial, I don't mean rent per square foot. I mean, what does it look like on the balance sheet? Yeah. But for most people in the corporate real estate side of the world, like you have HR background, you get into property, you don't necessarily understand the intricacies of balance sheets and P&Ls unless you've gone out and learnt about them or been taught them. You don't get, you know, that was not any topic when I went to university. And, you know, it's only recently that people have cottoned onto that.
I think it's a real gap. I really do.
Yeah.
I'm managing my 600 plus million budget right now, and I have that accountability. If I don't know how to manage a balance sheet and P&L, and I'm lost. So to me, you really can't progress as a leader unless you build these wider management skills.
Yeah. It's one of the questions I like to ask people, but tangential conversation. But you know, now a lot of people talk about lifelong learning, the fact that we're all working later in, you know, into our 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
People need to go back to university and potentially on courses, open line courses, whatever it happens to be, and learn new skills. And you know, the question is, if your 20-year-old self could start again, what would you study at university? And I think for a lot of people who love real estate, it probably wouldn't be property. Because as you've been saying in three or four different ways, you can't learn a lot of that on the job. And it's hard to learn it from books. Whereas the finance stuff is much easier to learn, I think, at university than it is on the job. Because you've got to find finance courses that relate to what you're doing. And that's hard, and so on and so forth.
If I had my time again, I would probably have really focused on business management. Maybe, you know, done a few years in a certain profession. Whether it would have been property, I don't know. But then I probably would have done an MBA or something.
And business management mean how businesses operate and are managed.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
You're saying that skill would allow you then to put real estate into the terms that the business understands.
Absolutely. At Standard Chartered, I was described by my boss as the bank's number one risk manager because I looked at property as a risk.
Right.
It wasn't only the risk to its financial performance, it was to its legislative obligations, to its reputational damage that can be done. It affects everything.
Yeah, from financial
customers,
to health and safety. And yeah, and I guess with a bank, you have it a huge amount more perhaps than other companies because you've got customers coming in and out of your retail branches every day. So you've got all the issues that go with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's back to you understanding what the business is about and then putting it into real estate terms.
Yes.
Interesting. So maybe, I know you worked at Shell, you're now working, as you mentioned earlier, in government, as it were. There's clearly a big shift from a bank to a big oil company. Was it very different?
Well, they were both big global businesses and global roles, so it wasn't that different. And there's a lot of process around banks and more coming all the time. In Shell, there was an awful lot of process that was there. But I was in the retail business. And what was interesting, the reason why I took that job and I was so interested in it, was actually I was in the retail business. I wasn't in property. So I was doing a property role in retail, which was fascinating because it was, to me, the natural progression from being a real estate executive to then being a real estate executive in a retail business. I loved it.
Just so that's clear, so the retail business at Shell, which is obviously massive, employs a team of people for the forecourt shops and everything else that they do in the retail sense. And within that team, are you saying there wasn't a property function, but you were in charge of property as part of the business?
I was brought in at global level to create a center of excellence that supported all of the business country management. And as part of that management, they would have network planners and sometimes they had property management people. Mm-hmm. And what they wanted to do was to show them what best practice looked like for property and how you would work on property. Very quickly, you could see that we needed to come together with network planning to actually show network planning the effect that property can have on their planning of where they should put a profitable petrol station.
And I guess with your banking experience, the retail part of the banking, that allowed you to take that job and have some understanding of retail. So, I mean, at this point, you've done local, regional, global roles. You've done it for big computer companies going through massive M&A.
Yeah.
Done it for a bank, now in a big oil company, but doing retail. It's quite a varied career. And then you've stepped off out of that into which I imagine is a very different world, but it'd be interesting maybe to talk about the public sector and particularly, again, from a leadership point of view, meaning you've probably got a different set of stakeholders or people with different views. You're obviously no longer working for a company that's trying to make money. You're distributing money, obviously. Can we just talk a little bit about that switch and how different it is and what the sort of learnings are?
Yeah, what's different about it is the stakeholder versus shareholder, I think, is probably the biggest difference, because when you're working in the private sector, you absolutely know that it's all about the bottom line and the impact on that bottom line and making sure that you achieve all the strategies, delivery plan. It's very focused on that. When you go into government and in the department I was in and am in, the focus is very much about having to show value for money, because after all, you're dealing with taxpayers' money. So you have to make sure that you can always demonstrate that. So there is a lot of governance and approvals around that. And it's approvals at a much wider stakeholder group than you can ever imagine. It goes from Secretary of State, ministers, Cabinet Office ministers, to businesses, to different departments, to actually people working on site. So you're constantly managing that stakeholder environment. And that takes a lot of time.
So it's different because there's not the, well, there is a driving force, which is financial. It's a different set of rules, maybe, and you're dealing with government. So I imagine that they, I mean, what's the equivalent in your world to the waste paper bin in the corner, I guess is my question. Well, maybe that's an unfair question to ask you. But
no, I suppose, again, it comes down to the cost. Is it affordable? Is affordability and economic value? It's also all of the government commitments on things like sustainability, targets on, you know, how you're achieving your utilization and efficiency. Because these are all published and they're in the public domain. And therefore, you have to absolutely be rigorous in the way that you're looking at all of these things, which I think in the private sector, it's not quite as rigorous as I'm finding it in public sector.
Yeah, I guess they can. You can probably get away with not doing quite so much and not have shareholders necessarily noticing, complaining, thinking you should do something. Whereas in the public domain, I guess the politicians are always worried that that department's going to get called out by someone for not doing something that someone in the public thinks should be being done, even if it's not necessary. Or
once you publish your targets, you have to
hit them
and deliver on them. Yeah, and again, you know, at the end of the day, you've got FOIs, freedom of information, you've got parliamentary questions, you've got all of this, so you're always in the public scrutiny. That you have to do it the way that it needs to be done.
So I imagine the pressure of the job as the person running the real estate is presumably there's more pressure because of that public scrutiny, let's say, than you would have running the retail global real estate at a big company like Shell. It's different, but
the pressure's still there in either one of them, but it's that, as you say, it's always making sure that you've got the audit trail.
Yeah.
And that you're meticulous in the keeping of the audit trail, which in private sector you're maybe not quite as conscious of. You're doing it, but you're not conscious of the fact that there's a very prescribed way it has to be done. But, you know, you're seeing the changes coming through on the financial world. It's getting much more that way. Shell was a good introduction to that because they're quite rigid in that way, so it was a natural progression, I suppose. If I had come from my world when I was in computer sciences to public sector, I wouldn't have survived, I don't think.
Yeah. Actually, it raises for me an interesting point, which people, I guess, more are talking about more, but when you're running something and it's big and it's complex, it has all these different pressures and different, we've talked about different shareholders and stakeholders and who needs what, but how have you dealt with, and you've had, you know, obviously a really interesting, difficult, complex jobs, and I know you and I laugh about this, but, and you know, we just sort of get on and do things, but how do you actually deal with the pressure of that complexity and dealing with people who just need answers when they want them, and a, you know, we could might describe some days as being unreasonable in their requests, but nevertheless, they're in charge and we're not, so we have to do those sorts of things. Again, is that something you've consciously thought about and have mechanisms that you use to make sure it doesn't get out of control, or is it or not?
I don't consciously think about it, but I have recognized that over the years what I've done is I've got a sort of a group of individuals that I know, that I've known them for many years, and we can meet up, and I know that people I can call on if I want to say I just need to talk something through. Could I just pass something by you and we'll maybe go and have a drink and chew out? You know that. I've done it with you often enough. And at the same time, I make sure that I've got, again, it comes to the team that you work with and the people that you work with and how it blends together. And it's really having a close group It's really making your team feel that they have got a part to play in all of this, yeah. that they're as equally important and that I rely on them. I'll support them, but I rely on them as well. So I'm quite open with them. I'm very open, and they know when I'm under pressure and I know when they're under pressure. And it's creating that safe environment for people to work in, right. I think is really important to manage pressurized jobs.
And be able to talk about it and yeah. it not be something that's seen as a weakness or something
Absolutely.
That's going to mean that the work isn't done in the right way, but it's yeah. okay, you need a hand, and, yeah. and we're all here to do
yeah.
that.
Because yeah.
I do think that, I've certainly noticed that in my career, that the pressure, I mean, it's something to do with getting more senior, but it obviously gets larger and larger the more responsibility you have and the more people you have working for you. And then the flip side of that for me is, as you've, and you've really said it since the beginning of this conversation, you surround yourself with people who are good at what they do.
Yeah.
And as a, which may sound obvious to some people, but actually finding really good people in different areas who you can trust, who have the time or the flexibility or the ability to help you, isn't necessarily as easy as it sounds.
Yeah.
But being able to go, you know, I need someone who can help me with some big retail problem I've got in country X, and being able to find someone quite quickly is a really good way of releasing pressure.
And it's interesting, it's also looking at future talent. So spotting future talent where they haven't spotted it in themselves at that point in time, but actually knowing that they've got the appetite for it and helping them along the way. And then finding people that are really quite happy doing what they are doing and want to continue doing it, but they give you a really valuable service.
Yeah.
And being able to show them that they are equally as important as those that want to get on and are yeah. talent that you're going to develop. It's really getting that blend. I was asked a question last night that I found really stopped me in my tracks, because it's something you mentioned earlier about lifelong learning. Mm-hmm. And I was asked, you are on that journey. You're clearly a lifelong learner. You like to do it. What are you learning at the moment? And it really stopped me in my tracks, because I've been so focused on, oh, this is my last few years, I don't really have to worry. But actually, he was absolutely right. I am still learning. And to me, and the response was almost instantaneous, I said, I'm learning that I have to bring people into my team who are current, who challenge my thinking.
Yeah.
Because I've been doing it for a very long time. I need people that are thinking differently, are doing it differently, are not afraid to challenge me and feel comfortable that they can speak up. So you have to create a safe environment for people to come in and feel they can work like that.
Great. Irene, I think that's probably a super place to stop, because there's so much more we could talk about, but we'll be here for the rest of the day. But I think that idea of the future, and as you say, and we're not in a dissimilar place, we're at the end of our careers, not the beginning of them, but having people around you who are challenging you, the sort of that well-worn phrase, it keeps you young. But as long as you're learning, you're interested, as long as you're interested, you're thinking, you're engaged, and you're curious, which is the word I always use. If you've got people who are curious about what they're doing, and it doesn't matter if you're 22 or 62 or 102, as long as you're curious, then you're going to deal with a lot of the things that we're talking about, the leadership, the pressure, the how do you get teams to work together, the diversity of those teams, which is the things that you've been talking about.
Yeah.
So fascinating. Thanks very much for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
And I will see you soon.
Thank you.